It's 10:06. Well, what happens when companies founded on values and altruism are bought out by giant corporations that exist for profit only? Well, that's the question we're going to tackle this hour. Good morning, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. One after another, companies specializing in socially responsible, sustainable, and organic retailing and manufacturing are being bought out by large corporations. The question is, can these brands still be trusted? Well, that's the question Christine McDonald poses in her article for E! Magazine titled The Big Green Buyout. Christine McDonald is a contributing editor for E! Magazine and author of Green Inc. An Environmental Insider Reveals How a Good Cause Has Gone Bad. She joins me by phone this morning. Christine McDonald, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start by looking back to the 1980s and into the 90s when a lot of entrepreneurs were looking for ways to match their altruistic values with their business sense. Talk about what that was like and who these idealists were. What was it they wanted to accomplish and how did they succeed?
Well, kind of as an offshoot, I guess, of the 1960s and 70s when people were starting to try to look at ways to save the world, some people were actually entrepreneurs, and many companies got started. I think by the 80s, there were more than 100 of these little companies that had begun to provide what was at the time not even called organic, but natural foods, or had a social mission in addition to their effort to make a profit. And they grew and grew, and they benefited from the fact that the bigger companies didn't pay them much attention. Mainstream companies really ignored their growth, and they were really ridiculed. Ben and Jerry's, I think it was Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's, told me that they really, these little companies that had a social mission really felt ostracized by the mainstream business world. So places like the Social Ventures Network was like an early forum, kind of a conference where people would come together and talk about these ideas. And it really took off to the point where they were growing so quickly that corporations started to take notice and began snapping them up. And today, according to one researcher who's been following this trend, there are only about 18 independent companies left out of more than 100. And if you look at the list, it's interesting. Many of them are cooperatives. So the cooperative model seems to have done better at remaining independent than the more traditional startup.
You mentioned Ben and Jerry's. That was probably the most high profile acquisition, and it was not without a certain degree of controversy. Talk about them a little bit, and what has happened to that brand since it was snapped up by a bigger company.
Well, I have to point out that both Jerry Greenfield and Ben Cohen didn't want to talk about Unilever's handling of, you know, management of their company today or since the buyout, which is typical. Unfortunately, few founders are really willing to talk. Either they sign confidentiality clauses, or they continue working in some way with the corporation. But one way or another, founders often don't want to talk about what happens after they leave the company. And that was the case in my interview with Ben and Jerry. But they were very, very generous talking about their experiences leading up to that point. And it's really quite interesting. They did a number of kind of innovative financing things. They did the first state in-state IPO in Vermont, which allowed regular Vermonters for a few hundred dollars to buy stock in the company. This was one of their first the first ways they raised money, which was very innovative, but later on it came back to haunt them because they had these shareholders who had a say in the company. And that was really kind of a common denominator, talking to founders, where you get your money. You know, if you have to be very careful who you take investment from, because many of the cases where things went awry, where founders lost control of the company and the company's mission, had to do with the fact that they needed funding for one reason or another, and they went into business with investors who didn't share their values.
Almost sounds like the plight of some musicians who, to get some money early on in their careers, ended up selling all their materials to someone else and lost control of them. There have been some things that have happened with Ben and Jerry's since then. They were challenged on the naturalness of the ingredients in some of their flavors.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah, good point. I think it was last year. It's in my story. Now Ben & Jerry's, which has been owned by Unilever for many years, it no longer bears the word natural on its label because they were challenged by a nonprofit group that pointed out that something like 48 out of the 53 flavors that they make had chemicals or somehow unnatural ingredients in their ice cream, which is very common today. And as a matter of fact, it's interesting that they removed the word natural, because usually natural is what what watchdog groups tell us is that after a corporation buys a trusted or organic company and or organic, that oftentimes the ingredients change, as well as your social commitment, and things like the packaging will change and the package will get smaller, so you're paying the same price but for less. One big way that these companies have made a change is to, if the ingredients were organic, to change the word organic to natural, which is rather, there's a confusion in the marketplace about what natural means. It really doesn't mean anything. It's really kind of a nebulous word these days that can be slapped on anything. And for instance, the Ben & Jerry's ice cream with chemicals in it until recently, and also Dean Foods, one of the biggest food producers in the country, had bought out Silk soy milk a few years ago, about a decade ago. And just a year or two ago, they moved away from their commitment to only use organic soybeans, and they changed the word on the label to natural. After they were called out on this, consumers balked, and Whole Foods Market and a number of other grocery chains around the country have actually pulled Silk from their shelves, because Silk was not only abandoned the organic label, but they were continuing to sell the soy milk at the organic premium prices.
And the soy they were using was there some talk about it being genetically modified?
Well, it was simply not organic. That has been another controversy, but I don't believe that came into play with the Silk soy milk. That has been a problem with some of the other labels. For instance, some of the organic and vegan food manufacturers have had that problem where they have been using genetically modified products such as soybeans or beets, and their consumers are not happy with it.
Mm-hmm. The term organic actually has some meaning, because the USDA passed rules about what you can call organic and what you can't. And so there are actually some standards, maybe not as tough as some people would like, but there are some standards about what we can call organic and what we can't in terms of food labeling, aren't there?
Yes, very, very much so. I didn't mean to give the impression that wasn't the case. Organic definitely stands for something. There's a legal definition of it, and it's true that there has been a lot of debate over whether organic products really whether the standard is tough enough. But at least there is a legally binding standard. And what a number of companies, in addition to Dean Foods with Silk soy milk, but also Kellogg's company Kashi, a cereal company, they have been criticized for moving to natural, to using the word natural, which doesn't have a legal definition. There is no legal definition of what is considered natural, and that has been kind of more the slippery slope that manufacturers have moved to lower their costs.
Well, let's talk about that word, because, I think words ought to have meaning. I think a lot of other people do, too. What do you think of when the word natural comes up? What do you think of? And that I'll throw that out also to our listeners. When you see a product that is labeled natural, what do you think of? What does that, what image does that call up in your mind? Here's the number to call, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What does the term natural mean to you on a food label? What are your expectations? And Christine, I'll ask you first, what do you think of? What do you think natural should mean if we're going to let food manufacturers put that on the labels of the products we buy in the store? What ought to be behind that?
Well, I agree with you that when I see the word natural on a product, it does signal in my brain some comforting idea that this is a good product. But I would say that consumers are very skeptical of labels, and they have every right to be. I mean, there's a lot of skepticism. One of the things that that companies that buy little trusted brands do is they keep it all very hush-hush. It's very hard to get information. Most of the companies that they're buying are private companies. And they often don't announce these acquisitions, or if they do, they just do it in business publications that the mainstream, public doesn't read. So people are wary of what is being said on labels, and companies are even aware of this and go out of their way to hide the origins of their ingredients and the fact that they own these companies after they buy them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because according to your article, the big companies are paying a premium for the brand. They're not necessarily buying the product as much as they are. They're buying the brand. You talk about Coca-Cola and its purchase of Honest Tea. Mm-hmm. They noticed that here was a brand that was very trusted. And they wanted to buy that trust because, let's face it, most consumers don't trust big companies anymore, and that's just a fact. And so you've got these little companies they're buying up, but they're paying a premium. They're paying 1.5 times revenue, maybe even twice as much as some of these companies are actually worth, just to get the trust. That's one thing, but I wanted to follow that with this. Why would, after buying a company based on this, they paid a premium because the brand name is trusted, mm-hmm. why would they do things that would risk that trust? That doesn't make any business sense to me. What am I missing here?
That is a very good point that many people who I spoke with for the article, many of the founders themselves and other people who study and are experts in the field, there is this... Maybe it's just human nature, you know. The big corporations purchase the little company because the little company has something that they don't have, and that is elusive to the big company, this ability to inspire people and to really innovate a product line. And yet once they buy it, the tendency of big corporations is to standardize everything and make everything harmonious in terms of policies and ingredients and all of that. And oftentimes, I think it was... Greg Stendenpool from who started Odwalla said, you know, once the entrepreneurial spark and the real authenticity of the company is gone, the customers usually follow. So it is at catch-22, and it seems that the bigger success stories, such as Stonyfield Farm yogurt, which is going on a decade now, it just completed a decade as a subsidiary of the French yogurt company. They seem to do better because they've left the CEO, the founder, in charge, and they've pretty much given him a great deal of autonomy, and they haven't standardized everything. But at the same time, and Honest Tea is also going down that path. Goldman told me that he sees himself as having a certain amount of autonomy, and he expects that to continue because companies want they're interested in this experiment as well. Like corporate leaders are interested in learning how to become more trusted. They, as a few people pointed out, they want to, so to speak, peek under the hood of these little companies and find out how they do it, how they both make a profit, or some of them aren't making profits, which is part of the problem, but many of them do make a profit while still producing a socially good or an environmentally or health-oriented good product. And yet they do it by maintaining values that their customers like. And so the companies are curious about learning how to do that, but whether it will translate into anything more than marketing spin, it remains to be seen. That's a kind of a very nebulous area. I mean, we do have corporations that are really talking, you know, the good corporation talk more and more these days, but for the most part, we haven't seen, you know, the jury is still out whether any of those efforts at Walmart or at Coca-Cola or Unilever are really going to go beyond playing lip service.
All right, Christine McDonald, hang on. We're going to take just a moment here, and then we'll get some callers in. I'm going to toss this out to our listeners. What do you think if some organic brand that you have patronized over the years, you suddenly discover that they'd been purchased by a large multinational corporation, for example? How would that change your view of the company, of that product? Would you still buy it? If nothing had changed, if the ingredients were all still the same and maybe the corporate mission hadn't been altered, would you still buy it? Would you be suspicious? And what would you do? I'd like to know that. And then, you know, what are your expectations when you look at a label and you see the word natural on it? That's still out there. 800-486-8655. Still a chance for you to get in right now on our discussion. 800-486-8655. My guest, Christine McDonald, E-Magazine contributing writer, author of Green Ink, an Environmental Insider, reveals how a good cause has gone bad. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 24 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 11:45 this morning, Larry Mueller talks about Summer River Fun, with a special focus on the driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin. That's coming up later this morning here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the countless number of green brands that have been snapped up by big corporations. We're talking and wondering what you think. Can these brands still be trusted? My guest is Christine McDonald, E-Magazine contributing writer, author of Green Ink, an Environmental Insider reveals how a good cause has gone bad. Let's go to the phones, and we'll start in Burlington with Clint. Clint, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The question was, you know, would I still buy the product knowing it was purchased from a corporation? If nothing has changed, I wouldn't. And to prove that in my life there, when Walmart, you know, in the 80s and 90s, Made in USA was everywhere, and then that was suddenly taken away, I had no problem not going into Walmart. So with them, if they wouldn't have changed anything, I'd probably be one of the biggest advocates, you know, for them, and definitely against them and what that was, but not about Walmart. But no, I wouldn't change it at all. And what does natural mean? That should just be a basic question. That shouldn't be, you know, anything that's gone over too much. Natural is just simply natural. Nothing's added to it. It's natural.
Okay, Clint, thank you. Christine McDonald, you want to comment on what Clint had to say?
I think that's a good point, that most people, if they felt that they could count on the corporation not to change anything, they might stick with the product. I think the problem is that we just don't have enough information. And also, one of the people I interviewed from Food and Water Watch pointed out another aspect of this whole question. When corporations buy these smaller companies that were rooted in a local economy, they're suctioning out all of the profits to a centralized corporation and their shareholders, and those profits that had been kind of circulating through the local economy are no longer there. So, there is a wider question here about how our economy is structured and what makes sense going forward, especially we've been in this, you know, we're no longer in a recession, but we continue to kind of lumber along, and the economy seems to not to be working as well as it used to in the past. And there are people, Jeffrey Hollander, who I spoke with, and several of the other founders that I spoke with, who are looking at, for instance, Jeffrey Hollander is looking at starting a new enterprise that would help fund cooperatives and other forms of businesses that aren't set up for outside shareholders. They're set up for the community, for, you know, the people who run the business, but also the community, and you know, the wider society. And there was an interesting theme that I heard from many of these founders questioning whether business as usual is really going to solve the problems that we are all facing, and that consumers in opinion polls again and again talk about how they would like better products and they would like companies to act better. But at the same time, consumers very infrequently put their money on the higher priced product just because it's green, or unless there's some real health benefit to them or some lifestyle benefit to them, they in terms of green products, they really haven't done very well in the marketplace. So there's a questioning of whether we need to really rethink the whole business paradigm. And there are some interesting things going on, for instance, in the sharing kinds of businesses, like car share programs like Zipcar. Or here in Washington, D.C., we have a bike share program in which you buy a membership for a year, and you can pick up a bike at any of 100 stations around the city and use that bike for transportation, that sort of thing. So there are these new ways of doing business that are starting to be incubated, but of course they don't, you know, for instance, you can't share food, we need to eat that. So it doesn't solve all of the problems.
Clint, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Jeff, who is on the road. Jeff, good morning.
Yes, hello?
Go ahead, Jeff.
Hello?
Yep,
you
Jeff,
there?
You're on. Yep, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I can't hardly hear you, but good subjects all the way around there. I've listened to the past three. And I'd just like to say that's the problem with this country, is all these big corporations are buying up these little companies just like they did back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then they outprice the products to where it's no longer, the demand isn't there for it because it's priced out of reach and all for profits. And when these companies, corporations are buying out these companies, these small companies are also under the stipulation that they cannot restart a company and go back to their home ingredients, you know, that have been changed in that. So, you know, and these things need to be addressed with regulations, you know, and maybe deregulation of Ronald Reagan years was not the answer. Look what's happened to Wisconsin with dairies and everything, you know. Cheese has gone to California, crying out loud. But I'll listen off the air there because I can't hear no more on the phone.
Okay. All right, Jeff, safe travels. Christine, you want to comment on what Jeff had to say?
I think it's true that the playing field is so different today. I, in terms of regulations to regulate the amount of mergers and acquisitions that we're seeing, it seems that the federal government, even under the Obama administration, hasn't really taken a very hands-on approach to that. It doesn't look like we're going to get a lot more regulations these days. And in a lot of ways, one of the people I interviewed pointed out that the way money is made in the United States is by purchasing companies. Startups start up every year, and the end game for them is to be bought out by a large corporation. And this is how it works. They run at a loss until they get to a certain point, and then one of the most viable ways for them to have a return on their investment and pay their investors back is to be sold to a large corporation. And as one of the academics I spoke to pointed out, today, a lot of these organic and natural and trusted companies begin with that end game of the sellout to a corporate sale as the end game. And I think Honest Tea is definitely one of those. And it's a very different playing field than, say, Nature's Path, which the cereal maker. I also wrote an article about Nature's Path, which is one of a few dozen companies that are still independent decades after they started. And Nature's Path really got started. The company started in the 80s, but the entrepreneurs actually began in the natural foods business back in the late 60s, early 70s. And it was just a much more a very different path of growth. They first had to create a demand for their products. They had to create a demand from consumers, and then the consumers sort of became part of a movement with them in which they joined forces. And today, it's really once you become a part of a corporation, it's much more like the getting marketed to, and it's much more of a one-way conversation as opposed to more of a partnership between the consumers and the businesses.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jeff, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Camille, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you. I can hardly hear you, but I'm sure you can hear me. I am part of a already huge but still growing community in Michigan that is very savvy about the ingredients of the food that we eat. And so to the extent that the word natural means absolutely nothing, in fact, the word organic, you have to look carefully, because if a label says made with organic ingredients, it doesn't really mean very much. You have to know your products. And what we have going here, and I hope it is also happening in other states, is a huge local food buying movement. And to just give you a small example of how pervasive this is, I just went to a wedding with about 450 people, and I would say probably 99.9% of those people will not give up the level of nutrition that they need. I'm not speaking very clearly, but they know how important it is. This is what goes into our bodies, and so people know what they're buying. And everything that was served at that wedding was local, organic. It was incredible a food, and that's just one small example. And I'm thinking, if Michigan, which has taken so many financial hits, economic hits, over the past few years, can do this, then what state couldn't do this? So I'm just really glad that you're on, and I hope the corporations that are buying out these companies are hearing us.
Camille, thanks for the call. Christine McDonald, the local food movement may be having some impact here.
Thank you for the comments. And I think that is a very hopeful sign, although unfortunately, we have a wonderful local food movement and farmers market movement in Washington, D.C., where I live as well. And I think that is a growing, it's a very positive trend, and these big corporations are not lost on these trends are not lost on the big corporations. Unfortunately, if you look at who buys what, we're still, those of us who do look at labels and take it very seriously, try to get to the bottom of things, are still in the minority. I mean, vastly in the minority. Although there are some, in addition to word of mouth, which is really the best way to find out. There's some really interesting research. People are not necessarily going to go out of their way, according to pollsters, to look for good products. But if they've heard something bad about a company or a brand, that sticks with them. We're all more likely not to buy that brand or from that company. And I think that rings true to my own personal consuming experience. And that's what's concerning these big corporations. They're worried about protecting their brands because they've spent millions. It's really what they own. They don't. Big corporations don't really make anything anymore. What they do is they deliver it to us, they market it to us, they advertise it to us. It's their brands that really are the core value that they have. And they're very concerned about maintaining their reputation, the reputations of their brands, which is part of the reason they're buying these companies and part of the reason that is fueling their corporate social responsibility efforts to be seen as good corporate citizens. And we're going to see, I think one of the most interesting insights I had while reporting this was that corporations are going to become more and more under fire, and they're going to have to answer for their policies, for their ingredients much more as time goes on, because we have all of these new, at least here in the U.S., where everybody's so wired today, you can. I have an app that I downloaded onto my smartphone, which is called the Good Guide app, and you can go into the supermarket and you can scan the barcode of the ingredient, of the product, of any product, and see if it's been rated. Now, unfortunately, the Good Guide has already rated something like 100,000 products, but unfortunately, every time I go shopping, more than half of the ingredients that I scan aren't in their database yet. But theirs is only one of several projects like that, and we just need to give them time. And as time goes on, as consumers, we're going to have a wealth of information at our fingertips, and through using Facebook, Twitter, or whatever, you know, emails or just conversations with friends, we're going to be passing on a lot of that information to one another. And this kind of communication, it really takes away the power. You know, forever, corporations, companies, you know, little companies and big companies have told us about their products, and that's the only information we've had about it. But increasingly, we're going to have all this information that we share, and this creates a huge challenge for companies.
Well, I mean, if the consumer is going to have to pay a premium for something that's labeled organic, they want to know that they can have confidence that what they think they're buying is in fact what they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a credibility issue here, and if that credibility is questioned, that damages not just maybe the brands, the companies that aren't behaving, but there's some spillover to other brands that may not be doing anything wrong.
That is true, too. I think that we are just all very skeptical today as consumers. I think we are more likely to question. As a matter of fact, it's interesting, the word organic, because there has been, even though organic is much more, when you buy something that's organic, you're getting something that's much, it's more quantifiable than if you buy a natural product. I mean, you can know what you're getting. It's legally required that it passes certain bars. But the word organic has really lost credibility with the public because it went through such a bruising debate over the guidelines when they were being debated. And the public has become aware that a lot of farmers and other people in the know feel that the organic standard should have been tougher. And for some reason, that debate, it's interesting the things that stay in the public's mind. So sometimes even something, you might feel better about natural just because you haven't heard anything bad necessarily about something as vague as natural.
We are talking about the big green buyout with Christine McDonald, who is a contributing writer for E! Magazine, and wondering what you think about all this. Phone lines are pretty much full. A line should be opening soon for you at 800-486-8655. Remember, if you get a busy signal, you can always send us an email, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, or leave a comment on the wall at the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and we'll share that on the air as well. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today on the Ideas Network. The bloom of protest across the Middle East became known as the Arab Spring, but now many countries struggle with what comes next. The Arab Spring after 2 on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the big green buyout. Green companies formed on altruistic value systems and being bought up by larger companies. Can we still trust these brands the way we used to? What are the mechanics of this? One of the points in the discussion has been the definition of the term natural. How do we view this? My guest is Christine McDonald, E! Magazine contributing writer and author of Green Ink, an Environmental Insider Reveals How a Good Cause Has Gone Bad. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk next to David in Spring Green. David, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I worked in the natural products industry in the 90s and as a salesperson out of Chicago for a brokerage that sold natural products to what was a burgeoning industry. Whole Foods was just moving into the Midwest at that point from Austin, Texas. And natural, and I was going to trade shows for the industry, natural actually did have a meaning back then. It did have a definition, and that definition was enforced by the buyers at these retailers who bought the products from us, from the manufacturers and us salespeople. And primarily it meant, number one, it had to have, if it had sugar in it, it had to be unrefined sugar. And number two, it had to have either no preservatives. I mean, that was a point of debate. It either had to have no preservatives, or if it did have a preservative, perhaps it had to be a food-based preservative. For instance, I know that I worked for one of the companies we represented was a green juice, a barley grass juice line that used maltodextrin as a binder, as a preservative of sorts, and that was corn-based, but that was under a lot of scrutiny by some of the buyers. They didn't want to take the product because it had maltodextrin in it. Another example, the Tom's toothpaste line was under some scrutiny at the time because they used sodium lauryl sulfate, which is a foaming agent that doesn't need to be in toothpaste but creates that feeling of foamy, you know, toothpaste in your mouth that makes you think that it's making your teeth clean when it's really not necessary. So those were examples of products that were under some scrutiny, and sometimes your product would be rejected because it had either refined sugar or had a preservative.
Christine?
I think that's a good point that these, you know, what things stand for has changed over time. And before organic became a legally binding standard, I you know, the industry had its own way of, you know, its various different ways of maintaining quality within the industry. And I think, in some ways, I think that kind of scrutiny that you're saying that buyers would put products under, it still goes on today with certain co-ops and Whole Foods and other places. I think in consumers as well. The previous woman who spoke about her community in Michigan and how the local food movement has really taken off. There is a group of people. You know, there are a group of us who are concerned and are really looking at product ingredients and that sort of thing. But we represent a very small percentage of the public. I think it's less than 10%. And actually, corporations and small companies, all companies, are grappling with how to win over this bigger 20 or 30% of people who are concerned about the environment and their own health, but don't have the time or just don't take the effort to really delve into these issues. And so there's just a lot of skepticism about all claims. And the question is how to... there are a number of questions. Big companies, there are a lot of marketing, consultancies and companies that are out there trying to help big corporations market to this group of 20 or 30% of consumers who are concerned but don't have the information or aren't interested in spending the time to get the information. They're not necessarily looking, they're looking to convince those consumers to purchase their product, but does that mean that the product is going to be the best quality natural product? Not necessarily. So there are it depends on who you are and where how you're looking at this. If you're a small organic startup, you're looking at how to attract those people who aren't the diehard early adopters of green products. You're looking at ways of adopting this kind of bigger population of people who are maybe, you know, have less time or have busy families and two careers, families going on, and how to actually bring them into the fold, which I think is an ongoing dilemma, both in terms of greenwashing and actual greening.
David, thank you for the call. Ben and Merrill, you're next. Ben,
well,
good morning.
The label organic is a much better label than natural. The only thing I think of when I see the label natural is that it's not supernatural. and that even arsenic is a natural ingredient and could be used under that label. So I think you're going to have to jump to the conclusion that natural means basically nothing.
I would agree with that. I think it's true that many toxins occur naturally in the environment. And what does natural mean? It's a buzzword that resonates with us, and so it's very useful to companies who are marketing their goods. But it doesn't. It has no legal definition, and it doesn't mean a thing today.
Ben, thanks for the call. One of the things that you comment on or you report in your article. It comes under the heading of corporate copycats. So it's not just that corporations are snapping up natural and organic brands, but they're starting to replicate themselves in that same mold. Talk about that a little bit about that aspect of this.
Well, it's very interesting. Corporations are trying to convince us all that they are good citizens, both environmentally and in terms of their workplace policies and their commitment to consumer health. If you go to their websites today, you will see that a great percentage, probably more than half of the website, is taken up with various pages detailing their good corporate works. But this is really, and they're doing it because they feel that there's no other way to survive. That the corporate world is going through this transformation, and only companies that are able to defend their brands and have successful brands over time are going to survive and thrive in the future. As consumers continually tell them and tell pollsters. That they're concerned about global warming and water scarcity, issues of water in the air, pollution, and all of these myriad of different issues that are all interconnected, really, that are becoming more pressing in recent years, and really are many of them are tied into climate change. So, and companies themselves, I mean, CEOs are always looking forward. You know, they always have to be anticipating future problems that their company might have, for instance, if they're producing in China and there's not enough water, or they're producing in many of the places in the world where they're producing, they have to get raw materials to the factory, and shortages of raw materials, shortages of water, or skilled labor, these things are all going to affect them. And so they don't only take into account interest rates or labor forces. They also take into account a number of environmental factors, which is also making corporations think about global warming and how they can change their businesses. But there's a lot of greenwashing going on as well.
What do you mean by greenwashing?
That came out this month in another magazine called Miller McCune, and that compared the corporate responsibility talk of three corporations, DuPont, Alcoa and Cargill, to their actual operation. You know, it looked at rhetoric and reality. And many times what corporations are touting on their websites and in their annual reports and all of their marketing materials, if you take a bigger look and put it in context, it's really greenwashing. It really doesn't hold up to scrutiny. So I think there's a real concern here that corporations are talking like good corporate citizens, but it's not clear how far they're willing to go, because at the end of the day, they're still focused on making profits, short-term profits for their investors, mostly in the stock market. And just about everyone I spoke to for this and the other article pointed to the short-term market mentality as a real obstacle that we face to really developing more sustainable business models and a more sustainable economy.
We've got a couple of emails here and excellent questions, and we've only got about 6 or 7 minutes left. I want to try and get to both of these if I can.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one from Jackie in Oregon. Jackie writes, at the start of the program, you mentioned that businesses established as cooperatives were more successful at maintaining their core philosophies and practices. Why is this? Would you be able to expand on that point?
Mm-hmm.
So why are cooperatives doing better at this?
I think because they have better, they're better at keeping control of their finances, and they and their missions. So, you know, one of the biggest problems almost several people talked to me about was taking money from outside investors who don't have any interest in maintaining the social or the green mission. So basically, if you can control your you know, where you get your money from, you're in much better shape. And if you start thinking about that ahead of time, even better yet. So if you bring your employees in and they help finance the business, or you have some other cooperative model that involves the community, you have a much better chance going forward.
Here's an email from Cassidy who says, what does it say about the people who sold their companies to for-profits? Maybe they weren't so altruistic they weren't so altruistic as they portrayed themselves to be when they owned their company. Sounds hypocritical to talk them up so much when they are independent. Nothing wrong with seeking profit, but just be honest about it when you start up the company.
That's a very good point, and I was very huffy and puffy about people who didn't return my phone calls and who wouldn't talk to me about what happened after they sold their companies. I feel like these companies, they you know, when they get started, they enlist us all as their consumers to be part of their revolution, and then they sell the revolution out. And I definitely have to agree with the email writer there. But you know, at the same time, we don't really know all that goes on. Sometimes they lose control. One person who helped me understand it was Greg Stendenpole, who started Odwalla. And you know, his company, they had a problem with E. coli. They had an outbreak that was linked to their juice. So the company almost went under. They needed financing fast. They couldn't get it through the social networks, which were really quite nascent at the time. So they ended up taking money from venture capital money, but don't quote me on that. And that set them on a path in which they lost control of the company eventually, and it was eventually sold to a big corporation. And so you can't always, you know, the founders lose control of their companies, and it's not their fault. And other times, as he pointed out, you know, these are their babies. They don't want to do anything to hurt their baby, even if the baby is now a corporate, is part of the corporate fold. So they might also be reluctant to speak out because they don't want to hurt the future of the company they started. Although they're usually, you know, they might still have stock, or they might be consultants for the company. There are so many other reasons. They might have had to sign a confidentiality waiver in order to get their big payout. So there are definitely other reasons as well that are not so altruistic that founders don't speak out.
Now you used Honest Tea as an example both at the beginning and the end of your article. In the case of Honest Tea, they basically say that hey, our purchase by Coca-Cola was transparent. It was very public. We get something out of it. They need our brand, and we needed them to actually help us make money. I guess we don't want to maybe paint the picture that all of this is just evil and bad.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Seth Goldman definitely seems to feel that he's still in control and that he can still look anyone in the eye and defend the deal with Coke, and he believes he'll be able to continue to run the company going forward. And the fact is that they weren't making any money 13 years later, although maybe that is part of, it's funny, after I wrote the article, I heard from some folks over at Equal Exchange, which is a fair trade coffee cooperative in Massachusetts, and they basically have taken other financing routes, so they were never so unprofitable, at least they weren't unprofitable for 13 years, which has allowed them to grow without having to sell the company. It's still a cooperative. It's still partially owned by the workers today. So, you know, hopefully what Seth says is true, but he definitely has gone into, you know, his model is definitely a model which has folded quite nicely into this corporate buying pattern. And I believe it was, you know, he always saw that as his, you know, he did say to me that he expected, you know, that he would have to sell the company eventually because he needed to pay back his investors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different, so, you know, it's kind of more, it's not really one of the more innovative models out there. But hopefully he will be true and will speak up if things go badly.
Well, I'd like to wrap things up. From the consumer perspective, what should we be looking for? What should be on the lookout for as to be better consumers and to be able to make informed choices? How can we find out about some of these companies?
Well, I think, you know, download some of these apps. The Good Guide app, I think it's goodguide.org is their website. The Consumers Union has Greener Choices. It's a website where they compare different labels, and they also compare different certifications. Like, you have all these different green and fair trade certifications, and you can check them out there before you go shopping. I like the Good Guide idea better because you could be in the aisles and actually be checking products. Other things you could do is you could look out for, you know, things like palm oil. Palm oil is in just about everything from soap to potato chips. It's a very cheap form of oil that has been used in a lot of products in recent years. But the rainforest is being deforested to plant palm oil plantations in places like Indonesia.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Christine. I'm sorry, okay. We're out of time. But okay. I'd like to have more of a conversation about this. Christine McDonald, EMA Magazine contributing editor, or excuse me, contributing writer. Chrissy Peace produced this program. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.